Well, it's my job, particularly please the students, merely to introduce the director designate to the school, Sir Howard Davis. And obviously, it's a great pleasure for me to be given the honour, if you like, of introducing him. It's actually a real testament, I think, to the students to have taken a bit of a march on the faculty by getting Howard to come to speak to them first. Although, of course, you might think that the university is a place in which the students are, as it were, central to the activity. Some of the students these days complain that that doesn't appear to be the case. It's good news for them that our director designate has recognised the need to talk to them perhaps first and to engage with them and their expectations of the school as it moves forward over the next number of years. Howard Davis, of course, has got an extremely distinguished background, working both in the financial service sector and in the business world. And indeed, it's extremely fitting that the two societies, the Society of Banking and Finance, actually the Banking and Finance Society at LSE and the Business Society, have joined together to sponsor this lecture. These two societies are highly active. I remember the Banking and Finance Society from my days at LSE. The Business Society, I think, slightly newer, but both of these societies boast almost 1,000 members. And it's they've got an impressive range of sponsors, a list of sponsors that I, as a director of a research centre of the school, can only envy. Perhaps they can give me some advice on how to take the financial markets group forward. In his career, Howard Davis has, of course, recently been the director of the Financial Services Authority, the first unified Financial Services Authority, effectively in the world, set up in 1997 by the Labour government when it came into power. Prior to that, he was the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, and prior to that was Director General of the Confederation of British Industry. He's also served as Controller of the Audit Commission and has had experience working for McKinsey and Company, where I believe actually he once employed the leader of the Conservative Party, but I don't know the details of that. Perhaps you can fill us in. And he worked for him, William Hague. And he's also been an advisor to the government, including the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And he's a student. His student education was at Manchester Grammar School, followed up by a period at Merton College, Oxford. He also studied at Stanford University in California, where he obtained an MSc in Management Science. Howard Davis has got a number of interests, which I won't list. You can always read those in Who's Who. He is married to a journalist and sadly supports Manchester City. It's even sadder that I support Sunderland. But there you go. Okay. So what I'll do now is hand over the podium to Howard Davis, who I hope you'll give a warm thanks to as he makes this lecture to you, and then we'll follow that up with a few questions. So, Howard, thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you, David, for that introduction, and particularly thanks to the two societies, the Business Society and the Banking and Finance Society, for providing this opportunity for what indeed, as you say, is my first gig at LSE since I was appointed. And I'm pleased to see that there are societies like the Business Society and Banking and Finance. In fact, Atma Shivalanka from the Banking and Finance Society told me that they were now changing their name to be called the Finance Society. And rather curiously, this is particularly appropriate from my point of view, because one of the slight oddities about our new legislation, which I'll mention a bit later, is that the word bank has no meaning in the UK anymore. There is nothing in the legislation called a bank since we have sort of disaggregated financial activity. So it's entirely appropriate that you should remove banking from your title. There is, however, still something Sapna called business, you'll be pleased to know. So you're okay keeping the term business society. Now, I understood that I was speaking largely to the student body, and that is the audience, the target market, if you like, for what I shall say this evening. But my eyesight is good enough to see that there are one or two quite mature students here in the audience, and I hope you won't find it too dull. First of all, I should apologise for the rather late timing of this lecture, but I'm afraid I'm still rather busy at the FSA, but also couldn't do this last week when I was invited because I was playing cricket in Barbados, where I did rather better than the West Indies, I can tell you at the moment. Now, what I was asked to do was to speak about the FSA, but also, to some extent, about my plans for the LSE. Now, I have to say that there will not be very much on the latter point, because I will not be the director until October, so anyone who came hoping for a new strategic plan for the LSE for the next 5 years has the opportunity to leave now, because that is not what you will get. Though I will say a little bit about why I am coming to the LSE and the enthusiasms I bring to the job. And I shall also be happy during questions to listen to any comments you might want to thrust at me about the price of beer in the Three Tuns or whatever is most on your mind. Now, what I'd like to do is to try to do two things. One, to talk about what the FSA does and what we think is distinctive about the new approach to financial regulation in the United Kingdom. But also to weave into that something about the FSA as an employer, because my aim at the end of the evening is to have encouraged at least a few of you to think about whether it is somewhere you might apply. Now, I saw on the list of people with whom you, the two societies, have partnerships and whom you've had to lecture, that you have had some pretty glamorous employers here, some of the big banks and brokers, and particularly some of the big US investment banks. And just at the moment, I have to acknowledge that in relation to these other employers, the FSA has some serious disadvantages. They can offer more money, more glamour, more travel, more status in the wine bars of central London. We have only one current advantage, and that is we do have jobs to offer. We are classically a counter-cyclical employer, and at the moment, as a regulator, we are rather busy while the investment banks have not got a great deal to do. Indeed, we were rather amused on one of our milk rounds this year, not one I did, but we fixed our presentation at Cambridge, it was. And you never quite know when you make a presentation who you're going to be up against, and it so happened that we were head-to-head with one of the largest US investment banks. And they filled the hall and had a video overflow to another and talked to about 550 people. And we had about 20. But we also happened to know from talking to that investment bank that they had no graduate openings available for next year whatsoever and were trying to sell us 20 of their most recent graduates as secondees to the FSA, which shows that there are some things lacking in the student intelligence network about the employment market. Now, just the basics first. We do recruit at the moment about 20 graduates a year, but it'll go up this next year to 30. We offer a pittance of a starting salary of about 25,000, which is somewhere pitched in between the civil service and the banks. We are a highly multinational employer. We are extremely flexible on the nationalities of people we employ. We have a lot of continental Europeans at the moment and a lot of people from old Commonwealth as well as quite a few from the US. Obviously, there are work permit issues, though we are prepared to arrange marriages with some of our supervisors for people we particularly want to attract. No doubt the money is the furthest thing from your minds as high-minded seekers after truth at the LSE, and you will be more interested in what we do. Now, as David mentioned, the roots of the FSA lie in the reforms which the Labour government announced immediately after the 1997 election in the governance, if you like, of the finance of the country and of the city. And of course the change, which was the most significant and which has attracted the most attention, was the granting of independence to the Bank of England in respect of monetary policy. And the FSA restructuring of regulation was, if you like, the other side of that coin. Some people thought at the time that this was an unusual priority for an incoming centre-left government after 18 years in opposition. But of course, we have since learned that this is an unusual centre-left government, unusual in the sense that it's centre-left in the particular sense of being centre-right, though some people say it is centre-left in Texas, I'm not quite sure. But I, at the time, was the deputy governor of the bank, and unfortunately, in the week after the election, I happened to be on a trip to Argentina. You can see how beneficial that was in terms of what's happened subsequently to the Argentinian economy. And the Chancellor rang me up and said he was planning to do this, and would I shift away from the bank and go and be chairman of the new authority, and he was going to announce it in the Commons the next day. So I had an hour or so to make up my mind, and I agreed that I would take it on, but certainly was a somewhat accidental regulator, since I had gone into the Bank of England essentially because of my interest in monetary policy, which I had done at an earlier stage of my career in the Treasury. But then why did the government decide to introduce a single regulator? Well, first of all, as I've said, it was in a sense the flip side of the coin of independence of the Bank of England. The government took the view that if the bank was to be independent from the point of view of setting interest rates, it was better that it did not have the continuing responsibility for regulation of the banking system. Essentially, two arguments there, or possibly three. There was a vague sense that one institution having these two responsibilities was perhaps too much power in one set of hands. But the two other arguments, which I think have something to be said for them, is one, that there could be some, if you like, corruption of monetary policy if the monetary policymaker is also responsible for the health of the banking system, and the government wanted it to be very clear that the bank was making interest rate decisions for the benefit of the whole economy and not biased towards the interests of the banking system. The bank would, of course, argue, and I certainly did when I was there, that we were not in any way affected in our monetary judgment by the responsibilities for banking supervision, but one can see that that can be argued. I think more seriously, there is contagion risk if you are the financial regulator and the monetary authority. The bank undoubtedly suffered considerably in reputational terms from the problems of BCCI and Barings, whether or not the bank was in any way responsible for those failures. And from time to time in financial markets, if you're the regulator, unpleasant things happen. Institutions fail, and at least at the outset, you come in for a lot of criticism and indeed even quite a bit of abuse from time to time. And if you are a regulator and that's your business, well, that is understood, but at least it doesn't spread across into the reputation of the monetary authority. And I believe that, although that you might think is a rather soft argument, I believe it's one which has considerable force. But on the more positive side, there were some important reasons for rationalizing the financial regulation system that we previously had. The first and perhaps most important is the growth of financial supermarkets or even financial hypermarkets. I mean, if you look, for example, at Lloyds TSB, it is originally a clearing bank, but which had a savings bank, or what the Americans would call an S&L, savings and loan, tacked onto it in the form of trustee savings bank, a mortgage factory which essentially still operated like a building society, the Cheltenham and Gloucester within it, and it now has what used to be the second largest mutual life insurer in the form of Scottish Widows. What is that? Well, it's a financial holding company which has a number of different functions within it, constructed for various tax and legal reasons in different forms. But to get an understanding of the totality of the risks being run by Lloyds TSB and being created by Lloyds TSB in the rest of the market, you really need to look at that institution in the round. And the previous regulatory system was not easily able to do that. Linked to that, it was thought, and I believe there's some evidence for this, that a kind of one-stop shopping in regulatory terms would be a competitive advantage for the City of London. And as I say, I think that has been demonstrated, certainly that is what the market believes. Also, and linked to the first point about the financial supermarkets, the growth of credit derivatives in particular has facilitated the transfer of financial risk around the financial system. If you look recently at where the credit risks related to the large US corporate failures have ended up, it's quite interesting that some of the larger losses incurred in the UK as a result of the failures of Enron and WorldCom have in fact been in our life insurance companies. Not life-threatening losses as it happens, but one or two had large exposures through credit derivatives to those non-financial corporates in the US. And tracking those credit risks around the system is quite difficult and is certainly facilitated by having a single regulator. And there was also another slightly softer argument that faced with these very large financial institutions, and particularly the overseas-based institutions, you do need a regulator with some status, stature, and authority in order to be able to deal with them effectively. And the previous somewhat balkanized regulatory system did find it difficult on occasion to face up to these large international institutions. So with these arguments in mind, the government decided to merge the banking supervision parts of the Bank of England with 9 other regulators to create the FSA. Now, I can't actually remember the names of all 9. I'm only the chairman. You wouldn't expect me to know that level of detail. But they included, for example, the Registry of Friendly Societies, which actually was just a few doors up the road, the Building Societies Commission, the Securities and Futures Authority, the Personal Investments Authority, the old Securities and Investments Board, a piece of the Department of Trade and Industry, which regulated insurance companies, the Government Actuaries Department, or half of it anyway, part of the Stock Exchange, which handled the listing function, and all of that merged very quickly together into one authority. Interestingly, since then, quite a number of other countries have followed our example. It's not quite true, David, as you said in your introduction, that we were the first. Technically, the Swedes were in there ahead of us, as indeed they were in setting up a central bank. The Bank of England, it is often claimed on the bank's behalf that it is the first central bank, but actually the Swedish Riksbank was, and the Swedish Finansinspektionen was the first single regulator on the FSA model. But of course, in a much smaller market, and so not in many ways quite comparable. But since we set ourselves up, we have in fact, somewhat by accident I think, created a kind of global brand. There are relatively few UK global brands, but alongside Burberry and Lipton Tea, the FSA is now a kind of global brand. Indeed, there is a JFSA from Japan, a KFSA from Korea, an HFSA from Hungary, now a German FSA, an EFSA, as they call themselves, which is actually Estonia. And indeed, if you look at the EU, you can now see that Denmark, Sweden, Belgium, Ireland, Austria, Germany, and ourselves all have now single regulators roughly on the FSA model. There are, however, 2 very important holdouts against this trend, the US and France. And it's nice to know that on this crucial issue, the alliance between the US and the French is as strong as ever. In the US, I used to say I had 78 opposite numbers. But since the arrival on the scene of Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General, also regulating the securities markets in New York, I've discovered that I seriously underestimated the number of opposite numbers I have in the US. But in the US, there are both state and federal banking regulators. There is the SEC, but there's also the CFTC, which regulates the futures market. There is the Office of Thrift Supervision, which regulates sort of mutual credit institutions like credit unions, which we have. There are the state insurance commissioners. There is no federal insurance regulator. There is the FDIC, whose functions we also incorporate, and really quite a lot of others. There are probably about 100 opposite numbers, and even now, after 6 years, I keep discovering new ones. In the French situation, the French still operate, and indeed other southern European countries, a more traditional three-pillar model with banking, securities, and insurance handled rather separately. Now, you may say these sound like distinctions without a clear difference, but there is one serious argument which continues to rage around the world, and that is in relation to the appropriate role for the central bank in financial regulation. And as I argued at the beginning, our government proceeded on the basis that it was better to separate the two, but there are those who argue very strenuously that banking regulation should be a part of the central bank armory. There is some logic to that. Some central bankers argue that it's very important for a central banker to understand the dynamics of the banking system, and particularly the monetary transmission mechanisms, in order to operate monetary policy effectively. We would say that it's perfectly possible to do that, indeed the Bank of England would say it's perfectly possible to do that, without actually being responsible for the regulation of the banking system. In Europe at the moment, this is a debate of which generates more heat than light, I would say. And I think I am not being too cynical to suggest that some of the Eurozone central banks attach high importance to maintaining their role in banking regulation, as their role in monetary policy has, of course, drifted to the European Central Bank. And since some of these institutions, like the Bundesbank and the Banque de France, have 17,000 employees, and if monetary policy is decided in Frankfurt and banking supervision disappears to another regulator, then you have to ask just what is left for those institutions to do. So this argument rages internationally in finance ministries and central banks, and is certainly not completely resolved. But coming back to the FSA, the structure of the organization is that we are constructed as a private sector company. This is rather odd, you might think, and indeed is certainly unusual internationally. Essentially, the main reason for that is so that the expenditure of the FSA does not count as public spending. This is something which treasuries are desperately keen on, finding ways of recategorizing expenditure outside public spending. Perhaps more significantly, certainly from a management point of view, is that it does allow the organization to pay more market-related salaries, since we are not governed, therefore, by public sector pay controls. And the consequence of that is that we get no government money, and we are entirely funded by fees levied on financial institutions. And if you want to carry out any financial activity in the UK, you have to have an authorization, and indeed, as we call it, a permission from the FSA. So this is rather back to the future approach to funding, because it's like an old-fashioned sale of permits, effectively, in that that's what we do. We are monopoly suppliers of permits to undertake financial activity. And by selling these permissions, we raise about £200 million a year and employ about 2,200 people down in Canary Wharf. You may wonder why the market is prepared to accept that a monopoly regulator should sell these permissions, and in fact where our fees are not subject to any government override. And I guess the simple answer to that is, one, that on the whole, in relation to the size of the financial sector, we are quite cheap. But secondly, that if you compare the position in the UK with the position in the US, which is what our institution, many of our international institutions here tend to do, they can see that in the US, the SEC fees, for example, are controlled by the Treasury. And that, you may say, gives them some protection in the sense that there are politicians ensuring the SEC doesn't charge too much. What is the outcome? Well, the Treasury, the US Treasury, raises four times the cost of the SEC in fees levied on securities market participants. And fees of that kind are used as part of the revenue of funding the government. So the market knows here, at least, that whatever we do in terms of our charges, they can only fund 100% of them, and not 400% as they fund in the US. So on the whole, this system, which looks slightly curious to outsiders, has been widely supported in the city, and there is certainly no agitation to change it. But now that is the remit of the FSA, if you like, in terms of the breadth of scope and the structure. But what do we in fact do? Now, the simplest way of looking at this is to say that there are really two types of financial regulation, and I accept for those who are experts in this area that this is something of a simplification. But essentially, we do two types of things. One is what we call prudential regulation, and the other is generally called conduct of business regulation. Now, the prudential side is in a certain way intellectually the most interesting, although the least visible. And essentially, in the prudential area, we set capital requirements for firms, whether they are banks or insurance companies or brokers. In other words, we set a requirement for the amount of reserves they should keep in order to back the activity they undertake. But essentially, the judgment about capital can be resolved into one question, which is how risky should we allow institutions to be? Now, at the limit, it would be quite possible for me to ensure that no life insurance company in the UK ever failed. And one could do that by requiring them to hold 100% of their assets in the form of gilt-edged or cash. Now, given their cost base, that would mean that you would get a pretty guaranteed small negative return for each year you were invested in that life fund. So that might not be particularly appealing, but you would know that your capital was, broadly speaking, safe. As soon as you move away from that position, you introduce some possibility of risk and some possibility of failure. And the interesting question is, at what point should you set that? Now, you may say, why does the market not set this itself? And I think the problem there is that there is a kind of risk asymmetry in the market, in that in the short run, and the short run can be quite long, a bank which took on a large amount of risk with a small amount of capital, or an insurer certainly, could make large returns for a period. And there is a kind of asymmetry of risk facing the management, in the sense that if they make large returns now, they can pay themselves a large amount of money, and if they make a large loss in the future, then some government safety net will come and pay part of that loss. And therefore, there is a natural tendency, unless you have absolutely no safety net, for institutions to have an appetite, a risk appetite, which may impose costs on the rest of the market or on the public purse. And I think, ultimately, that is the rationale for having some kind of agency to set some kind of capital minimum. In doing this, however, life is quite complicated because, of course, you have to answer difficult questions like what is capital, which is by no means quite so straightforward as it used to be, because most of the instruments issued by banks and insurers have different features of risk attached to them, so that assessing what capital is quite tricky, and also assessing the size of their balance sheets and the risks they run is quite tricky, particularly given the increasing use of derivatives and hedging techniques. But underlying these decisions are really issues about how much tolerance of failure you want to have in the market, bearing in mind that if your failure tolerance is very low, you almost certainly reduce the ability of financial institutions to take on risks and to lend aggressively and to perform their essential economic role. This is quite a political activity in the sense that in the political arena, the theoretical tolerance of risk in financial markets is very high. The practical tolerance is very low indeed. And when our legislation was going through Parliament, all the rhetoric on all sides of the political debate was we did not want tight regulation, we wanted a light touch regulator, we wanted flexible markets, able to develop and make profits. And then the very first time there was any failure, which was of a small and rather insignificant in systemic terms insurance company, tons of bricks descend on the regulator as to why this was not prevented. And there is an extremely difficult set of issues here in terms of how we determine our risk appetite. We also, of course, have to operate within an international framework. There are rules set by the Basel Committee on capital for banks, indeed by the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, but there is still a lot of national discretion and local judgment about how these rules are implemented. And that is really one large part of what we do. The other side of regulation, which I generally call conduct of business, is more difficult to describe succinctly because it can cover a very large area. And probably the best is to give you just one or two examples of the sort of issues that we currently face and how we're resolving them. In equity markets, the biggest issue, of course, is always insider dealing and market manipulation. And under our new legislation, we were given new powers to police insider dealing. These issues are very difficult to resolve because it's quite hard to track information around the market, and it's quite hard to demonstrate when markets have been manipulated deliberately. Most recently, we did fine ABN AMRO, £900,000 for manipulating prices. You will recall, some of you, the famous Flaming Ferraris case in which Jeffrey Archer's son was involved at Credit Suisse, which was about manipulating an index around a particular time of day when the bank had a position from which it would benefit hugely if the index was below a certain level. And it put through artificial trades in a very large stock in order to knock the index down below a particular level at a particular time on a particular day. Those cases are quite difficult. Sadly, they are not so rare as you might hope. And they involve a lot of real-time market monitoring to look at unusual price performance and therefore through that to try to spot the possibilities of manipulation. But it won't surprise you to know that most people who want to manipulate markets do it in a rather careful way, do it through intermediaries, often do it through derivatives. And so this is quite difficult activity. A second area is in relation to company profit warnings and directors' dealings. We've had a number of recent cases in that area. One on profit warnings was, of course, the Marconi case, which some of you may have seen, where we concluded that Marconi were late in issuing a profit warning to the market. I should emphasize there weren't any directors' dealings in that case, but there are a number of others we're looking at the moment where it does appear that directors have conveniently unloaded some of their shares relatively hard in front of a profit warning. And we have certainly found in the last 2 or 3 years that particularly in a bear market, practices have not been as rigorous as they would be. Companies seem surprisingly more reluctant to issue bad news about profit forecasts of the market than they are to issue good news. A third area, which of course has achieved a huge amount of publicity recently, relates to analysts and investment banks and the way in which investment banks manage conflicts of interest. And you'll have all seen the particular examples in New York of those conflicts of interest. We have had less of that here. Some people say that's because the FSA has not been looking. I don't believe that to be true. I think there are some reasons why our market has been less vulnerable, and that is that it is more of a professional market. The retail market here is less significant, and it's quite difficult to move stock prices in this country by operating through retail investors, whereas that is possible, and certainly was possible in the US in the dot-com era. People like Mary Meeker and Blodgett and Grubman could undoubtedly move prices by their recommendations via their impact on retail investors. That is much more difficult in this country, and therefore the opportunities for the star analyst, if you like, to move the market are much less here. And indeed, I think few of you could probably name star analysts in the UK market, whereas I imagine most of you would recognize the names I've just quoted, which have emerged in the recent revelations prompted by Elliot Spitzer. So We have less of that in the UK, but nonetheless there are some cases of poor management of conflicts of interest, and we proposed some rule changes recently to try to address that. Another area is the area of senior management responsibilities in firms, trying to ensure that the right incentives are created in firms to manage them soundly. This is new in the UK and was prompted politically by the Barings affair, where Nick Leeson in Barings, who was of course the person primarily responsible for the collapse of the bank, did suffer and spent an uncomfortable few years in jail in Singapore, whereas some of the senior executives of the bank, including the chief executive, were not pursued by the securities regulators. Why not? Because there was no clear line of responsibility established within the firm between the traders and the chief executive. And so although the capital of the bank was allowed to go to Singapore in order to back that trading activity, it was not possible to identify the particular responsibilities that the chief executive had for managing that capital. That has now changed, and we have introduced a regime which establishes clear lines of responsibility for people at the top. Does that always work? I'm not sure that it always does, and indeed there are still many examples of chief executives behaving as if companies were their own fiefdom, but I think less perhaps here than elsewhere. One of the most amusing recent cases, one of the sort of sad things you do as a regulator is you tend to read rather lengthy reports on regulatory failure, because that's where you learn quite a lot. And there was a recent major regulatory failure in Australia of a company called HIH, which actually was the second largest insurance company in Australia, so its failure hit the headlines there, and they set up a Royal Commission, which finally reported only 10 days ago. And I thought, well, I'd better read at least the summary of this, and was settling down for a tedious Sunday afternoon. But when I came across the marvellous description of the way the chief executive of that company, a man called Ray Williams, operated, and he was the person who was chief executive through the point at which it collapsed, and he used to come to London, where they had a business which actually lost them over $1 billion, and he came first class on Qantas, but always bought two tickets, one for himself and one for his bag. And this was in order to maximise his frequent flyer miles at the company's expense. And Qantas eventually said, and this is all detailed in the Royal Commission report, that they refused to carry on booking these tickets for him because they weren't prepared to book a seat without a name. And so he named his bag Casey Williams, and it continued to travel with him backwards and forwards as he watched this business fall through the floor. A fourth area is, and the most difficult, frankly, is the regulation of the retail selling market in the UK. And this is about how to try to correct the uncomfortable information asymmetry there is in retail financial markets. Well, that is the prime justification, again, if you like, for regulation, where if you compare the purchase of a long-term investment product with, say, the purchase of a washing machine, if you buy a washing machine and take it home, you can quite quickly discover whether it works or not. Furthermore, the longer you've had it, the less interested you are in the financial viability of the company which made it, because in your mind, and indeed in your balance sheet, if you like, this is gradually depreciated as an asset. If you buy a pension or a life insurance policy, precisely the opposite is true. You can take it home, but you won't know whether it works for about 25 years, and during that period, your financial interest in the company which sold it to you increases as your relationship with that company grows. How can you cope with those risks? With the greatest of difficulty. It is extremely difficult for any individual investor to carry out the due diligence, and it's also extremely difficult for any investor to check the validity of the claims being made about that policy. Therefore, you have a regulator which is able to discipline firms if they make unreasonable claims and unreasonable promises, and also able to monitor that the company is keeping reserves which will allow it to pay out on its promises at the end of the day. This, however, is an extremely difficult area, because there appears in this market to be a chronic market failure, in that companies and their, well, particularly the intermediaries, are heavily motivated by commission and heavily motivated by the desire, therefore, to make a sale. And requiring them or persuading them to consider suitability, to consider the risk appetite of the investor, is extremely difficult. And unfortunately, one would have to say that over the 15 years in which we have had this kind of conduct of business regulation since 1988, there has been a series of mis-selling cases, and it is very hard to say that things are improving. We had personal pensions mis-selling, where somewhere about 1.5 million investors were mis-sold, and the companies have had to pay back compensation of around £11 billion, which is the largest consumer compensation exercise undertaken anywhere in the world, we think. More recently, we've had endowment mortgages, many of which were undoubtedly sold to investors who didn't understand that they were taking an equity risk to provide the repayment vehicle for a mortgage with a fixed nominal sum. We've more recently had the egregious case of split capital investment trusts, where many investors have lost all of their money by being put into highly geared equity investments, and in many cases without any explanation being given to them of the risks they were taking on. In all of these cases, we have had to take enforcement action to discipline firms, sometimes by expelling them from the market entirely, sometimes by fining the firms or individuals, in all cases by requiring them to compensate investors. This is fundamentally rather a depressing picture I paint of the retail market, and I wish I could say to you that I believed it was improving, but it's very hard to produce any evidence of that. The third area, which I won't talk about in any length, is that we are supposed to try to improve financial literacy, to improve public understanding of the financial system. And indeed, we are making a start on that. We've developed a lot of curriculum materials in schools, and your successors, who have passed through the English school system anyway, should see some evidence of that in the sense that they will have Financial Services Authority curriculum materials presented to them during the citizenship part of the national curriculum. This is rather unusual as an objective for a regulator, but one which we think in the long term is likely to pay off as an investment. One of the big issues, briefly, that we are currently trying to grapple with, some of them I have alluded to as I've gone through my description of what we do. At the moment, there is one very difficult issue in Europe, which is just how much European regulation should there be if we have a single financial market? And can we leave regulation at the nation state level, or should there be a single regulator for the whole European market? If there is, how does that regulator enforce its rules locally? Our view on that is, for the moment, national regulation seems to make most sense in the absence of a developed European court system. But undoubtedly, as the single financial market grows, the issue of how you regulate that market will, I think, come strongly to the fore. The issues of investment banks and their conflicts of interest, as I've mentioned, is an extremely difficult one. The business models of these large investment banks are riddled, if you like, with potential conflicts of interest. And it would appear from what we have learned in New York that these banks are not as rigorous in managing those conflicts of interest as they could and should be. The question for regulators, and we spend a lot of time discussing this with the SEC, is how do you find ways of enabling those conflicts of interest to be managed effectively, or encouraging them to be managed effectively, without destroying the economic benefits which certainly do flow from these large integrated financial institutions? And that's the underlying question beneath all of the Elliott Spitzer global settlement and the fines and all of that. How to regulate hedge funds is another current issue of some difficulty. Hedge funds, essentially unregulated entities. The managers are often here. The vehicles are often located in offshore centres. We've had some particular examples of long-term capital management, which came very close to creating a genuine systemic financial crisis in 1998, in spite of the number of Nobel Prize winners it had on its board. And how do you find a way of monitoring the activities of those hedge funds without, again, over-constraining them and preventing them from taking the kind of risks they do. Because in many respects, hedge funds are useful parts of the flora and fauna of financial markets. And certainly recently, we've sometimes been quite grateful for hedge funds because there hasn't been anyone else buying. And the ability for those funds to take counter-cyclical positions is, in fact, an important part of a vibrant financial sector. But nonetheless, you need to have some understanding of whether they are over-leveraging themselves and putting themselves in a position of long-term capital in 1998, where they could threaten the stability of the system as a whole. And, of course, in the retail area, the continuing issues, as I've mentioned, of split capital, trusts, endowment mortgages, the problems of Equitable Life, and the rest. If you were inspired to come as a new recruit to the FSA, what would happen to you? Well, like many organizations, we have a 3-year graduate program, and then you become part of our job market internally. If you did that, what might you do? Well, you might spend, if you're an economist, for example, you might spend a year in our risk assessment division, where we are looking at economic trends and financial market trends and trying to identify the potential risks in the system and informing the work of our supervisors. You might then spend a year supervising foreign banks in the UK. There are four now Iranian banks in the UK. Their financial viability depends on the viability of the Iranian financial sector, which involves some understanding of the oil market. Their London operations are their main window on the markets of the rest of the world, so they're not hugely welcome in the US. And so understanding the Iranian banks, in fact, involves macroeconomic analysis in Iran. You might, however, be involved in looking after a large group of financial advisors and monitoring their selling practice and trying to identify where there is a risk that they are stuffing their clients with unsuitable investments. You might then, like in a ministry, spend a year as private secretary to me or to one of the managing directors, and you would certainly, during this first 3-year period, have a secondment out. Investment banks are very keen to take our people on secondment, or it might be to the European Commission, or it might be to the IMF, or it might be to the New York Fed, or to the Australian regulator, or to the Hong Kong regulator, or, if you have a language, to another European regulator. And then, after 3 years or so, you would, as I say, be part of the job market in the FSA as a whole, and can then aspire to the positions all the way up the organisation. And if you look at the top, that we have 20 directors, each of whom have responsibilities in certain areas, whether it's on prudential side or on for a particular sector, and the directors earn from 130,000, 40,000 up to just over 200,000, and the youngest is 35. Also, I would say, for those who are not looking for a lifetime career, and we know a lot of people who don't think that way when they start, the FSA has already demonstrated that it is a pretty useful stepping stone elsewhere. Our turnover currently is very low, which is usually, as I say, reciprocal of the health of the job market in the city in general, and financial firms are not hiring extensively at the moment, so our turnover is currently only about 3% a year. But in slightly more favourable times, we've seen a lot of movement in and out into financial firms, and our people are quite sought after in the market. So far, recently, we have not attracted that many people from the LSE. In fact, we've only had two in, I think, the last 4 years, both of them still there, seem to be doing well, and we would like to increase that. We seem, for some reason, to have had more success at Oxford and Cambridge than we have at LSE. I'm not quite sure why that should be so. But why am I leaving this excitement and all of these thrilling issues and coming to the LSE? Well, partly I would have to be completely frank, and it's because I've had enough of regulation. As I said, I was rather an accidental regulator, and in fact I had decided and had announced that I was leaving the FSA anyway before I decided what it was I wanted to do. But after thinking hard about what I wanted to do, I decided that higher education, and particularly LSE, was what I wanted to do, and I would say Again, quite frankly, there are some personal reasons for that. I've spent a lot of time inside the government, broadly defined, the government machine, and I would like to have the opportunity to offer my views in a more, in a somewhat freer way than I have in the past. But also, I am very committed to the cause of higher education in the United Kingdom. It seems to me we have a small number of institutions here which can be globally competitive and which can play a hugely important role in educating particularly people involved in economics and public policy generally in the world. And I think the LSE is one of a handful of institutions who are in that position. And I don't think that it is particularly healthy, or it would be particularly healthy, if all of the institutions in that position were located in the US. This is not, I think, an anti-American point. That is certainly not where I begin. But I don't think it would be a healthy position if there were not strong European rivals for American institutions. And I think I can help, or I hope I can help, keep the LSE at the forefront of that market, which it certainly currently is. I've been astonished in the months since my appointment was announced to come across people all over the world who were here. I was in, after playing cricket in Barbados, I went to Jamaica for a bit of work, and the head of the financial regulator in Jamaica, where, what do you know, was here at the LSE, and so we spent a day together talking about their problems and what they could learn from us, indeed in one or two cases what we could learn from them. And so I hope that I can use my international experience to keep the LSE at the forefront, and we have to accept that the competition, particularly from well-funded and well-endowed institutions in North America, is strengthening all the time. So there's no point in thinking that the LSE can stand still. It needs to stay a lively, well-funded, and a relevant institution, attracting the best faculty in the world and the best students. And by the incisiveness and knowledgeability of your questions, you will tell me if we are succeeding on that measure at the moment. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Howard, for a fascinating talk, a beautiful description of the regulatory environment in the UK over the last 15 years or so. One or two people obviously have to go. If they could make their way out, then we'll take questions. I think Howard has thrown down the gauntlet. His talk was great. The object of the exercise now is for you to come up with some questions that are equally great, and draw out some really first-rate answers from Howard. I listened to CNN the other day when I was trapped in a hotel, and Larry King was talking about what it is to be a great interviewer. And he said, it's all about asking the right question. When you ask the right question, everything's right. Everybody likes it. So if we have a couple of questions, please. Okay, over here. Could you just say who you are first?
The head of the Fed in the US used the term, I think, irrational exuberance, I think about 5 years ago. And then I think he repeated it about 3 years ago. And neither seemed to have too much effect on the markets. My first question is, I was in Australia, so I haven't sort of kept up with what the FSA was doing. But can you tell me whether the FSA had any role in trying to dampen the markets and try and bring some sort of sustainable valuation model to bear to try and sort of stop this sort of irrational exuberance here? And secondly, Don Cruickshank gave a talk here at the LSE, I think about a year ago, where he spoke about how big the London market was overall vis-a-vis New York. And I was wondering whether the FSA has actually been promoting London as a financial centre as well.
On the first point, the FSA was came together as one organisation on the 1st of June 1998. And we did, during 99, make some disobliging remarks about equity valuations, and we had about as much effect as Alan Greenspan had. His rational exuberance was actually in 1996. Indeed, I well recall one occasion when I felt the most sort of dowdy and grey and dull of any time ever in my life was that I happened to be, quite coincidentally actually, on the Today programme on the day of the launch of lastminute.com. And I ended up in the studio with John Humphreys and Martha Lane Fox. And, you know, she was sort of, I mean, she'd just sold her company at 558 pence a share through Morgan Stanley, and it's, I think, even after its recent recovery, it's about 80p or whatever, 100p. And, you know, she was so excited, as indeed you would be when you saw all that money coming your way. And my sort of, you know, well, is this really going to be sustainable? You know, you could see nobody was listening at all. You know, nobody cared. And so it is extremely difficult to swim against the tide in those circumstances. And there's been a sort of boom in bubble research recently, as you may know. And most of the recent explanations of bubbles have been essentially psychological and based on sort of feedback mechanisms, where the kind of analytical approach that you can bring to this as a regulator or indeed as a central bank appears to play remarkably little role, certainly in the later stages, or what we can now see to have been the later stages of a boom. I would say, however, in partial defense, that we did not see here quite the same price excitement as we saw in the US. I mean, the P's of the London market never got to the stratospheric levels that the US markets were at the end of 1999. And the kind of analyses that were done by Goldman's, among others, looking at, you know, what the markets were telling you about the possible, about what you had to believe about the share of corporate profits in future GDP in order to believe that these stock prices were sustainable, that those calculations for the US really did cause you to say that this is, you can't possibly believe in these prices because you would need to assume that corporate profits were going to double their share of GDP. That analysis was not anything like as dramatic in the UK. It looked as if the market was historically overvalued, but not to anything like that. In fact, we had Gavin Davis in come and do that presentation to us about the UK, which did cause you to think that we were kind of, you know, we were leaping above a bit, but not to anything like the same as the extent as the US. Your second question was whether we promote the financial center, to which the answer to the question put in that form is no. And when the velvet divorce from the Bank of England occurred, we left the sort of city promotion responsibility with the Bank of England, because there is a problem really for a regulator in my view, in having a financial promotion role. I mean, there are some other countries where that is done, but it isn't here. I mean, for example, International Financial Services London, a very worthy organization which replaced British Invisibles, which has disappeared, has one of its measures tends to be, you know, the number of foreign banks in London. Well, I could easily increase that by accepting the applications from a number of banks who would love to have a branch in London and be able to put London on their letterheading, but where I frankly I'm very dubious about the kind of business they want to undertake here. And indeed, where I'm very dubious about the capital that they have to back their business back home. Some cases, some, you know, former Soviet Union countries, no doubt eventually they will be in a position where they're stable and they will be able to. And if I had a financial promotion responsibility, there are certain circumstances, and that's the obvious case, where it conflicts with your responsibility for the stability of the system. And therefore, we don't do that. We do, however, in our legislation, have a requirement to take account of the impact of our regulation on the competitiveness of the UK's financial markets. And the way we interpret that is by saying, well, if we are adopting super equivalent in the jargon rules, can we really justify them? Or are we just going to shift business offshore? And sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. And for example, we have, under the Bank of England regime as well, typically operated with capital requirements on banks, which are appreciably above the internationally required minima. So the Basel standard of sort of 8%. There's only a based bank which has an 8% requirement. Typically we have imposed higher requirements on that. We are entirely unrepentant about that. At the moment we have the strongest, best capitalized banking system in the world according to Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and we think that's a jolly good thing. And we think that actually requiring a higher level of capital has in fact been extremely good. And if you look at our system now by comparison with Japan or Germany, you can say that this well-capitalized status is in fact a competitive advantage. So it isn't always just about your, you know, the intensity of your regulation or the level of your capital, which is what is competitiveness. So we have that kind of requirement in our legislation to consider our regulation in relation to the competitiveness of London, but we don't have a financial promotion responsibility.
I'll take Richard Layard down here at the front.
Do you think enough has been done to reform the international financial architecture?
Well, probably, if you require a one-word answer, Richard, it's got to be no. But I think that more has been done than is often appreciated, in that some of the arguments about international financial architecture tended to resolve into whether we needed or we could have some kind of world financial authority or some sort of institution that would take more direct responsibility for the stability of the system as a whole. In my view, that is unlikely to be a realistic option, and that few countries are likely to be prepared to give up sovereignty to an international organization to write rules for their financial institutions. And what has really been done in the last 4 or 5 years, since the Asian crisis, which stimulated a lot of thinking about this, has been a lot of improvements, if you like, to the plumbing of the international financial system, while the architecture has remained reasonably constant. And the activity that I think is the most valuable and which we support the most strongly is the efforts being made to ensure that individual countries have independent regulatory systems and manage their own financial markets according to international best practice. And in the past, many countries said, oh yes, we agree with the Basel rules and we apply them here. And the Asian crisis in particular showed that simply wasn't the case, that the banks in Thailand or Indonesia did not have 8% capital and their institutions were not operating an independent regulatory regime. Since then, the IMF have set up a team to undertake financial sector assessments of countries. Initially they weren't published, now increasingly they are published, and they're pretty hard-edged, and they make firm recommendations for change in order to meet the international standards. And the IMF has started to sort of hint at some conditionality on future lending programs, because they recognize that while in the past they looked at their fiscal balances as to whether they were safe countries to lend to, they ought to be looking at the rigorousness of their financial regulation, because that can also cause international financial institutions to lose a lot of money. And so at the moment, although it's all, you know, rather detailed low-level activity, I would say that there is a lot of effort underway to upgrade the status of financial regulatory systems in countries across the world. And I think personally that that is a more realistic route than the kind of more glamorous arguments about new types of top-level international financial architecture. And we support those programs. We've inflicted it on ourselves in order to show willing, which was quite painful, but in the end quite beneficial, I think. And we lend people to these teams all around the world to do this work. So I think there is a program underway which needs to be pushed through. And it probably has got another 2 or 3 years to go before one can really say that it's, you know, that we've looked at all of these key countries and improved their systems.
Thank you. There was a question here. Could you bring the microphone across, please? Again, it'd be helpful if you just say who you are.
It's Peter Bamforth. I'm an ex-student who works in the marine insurance industry. From my experience over the FSA and having an Arrow visit, and from your talk tonight, it seems very much that the FSA is banking orientated, and what suits banking will be just rolled out over the other markets. Now that may not be your intent, but that's certainly how it comes across, and I'm not too sure that that necessarily properly reflects the risks between the retail markets and the wholesale markets. Particularly, going back to the gentleman over there, surely the people in the wholesale markets, if they make a loss, well, that's tough. And what happened to Caveat Emptor?
Yes, we have a Caveat Emptor clause in our legislation, which for a long time I thought meant beware of the dog, which is appropriate with some insurance salesmen. But we do have a differentiated regime between wholesale and retail markets, and we essentially disapply a lot of our rules to the wholesale market. One of the difficulties we face is that this approach is not widely supported elsewhere in Europe. And the approach that we have here, in fact, we have a three-tier market, really. We have a retail, pure retail, professional investor, and market counterparty. And for market counterparty transactions between Goldman's and Morgan Stanley, we disapply pretty well all the rules. And this is coming under some threat from the new Investment Services Directive, which may or may not allow us to do that. And so we certainly apply a much more differentiated regime in London in relation to wholesale markets than is the case elsewhere in the world, and that is undoubtedly one reason why London remains the centre for most wholesale business in the European Union. On your first point as to whether we apply a more banking-driven model, and we are applying that inappropriately to insurance. Well, I would plead, partly at least, guilty to that charge. And the reason I do is because, and the reason I'm happy to do so, is because I do believe, having had responsibility for both sides, both insurance and banking and a lot of other things for a number of years, that in many respects, the ways in which banking supervisors think about risk is to be preferred to the traditional insurance model. I mean, if you take a very simple case, but which does illustrate my point, in the case of Equitable, Equitable sold policies with guaranteed annuity rates. I mean, that's the essence of the Equitable problem. It sold them for about 30 years, from the mid-50s to 1988. And these said that, you know, when you retired and you took your annuity, you could cash it in and you would get a minimum of, say, 8%. And from 1958 to 1992, those minima were in fact below the market annuity rate. And then at various periods since then, they've been above the market annuity rate and therefore have been in the money. Now, essentially, in economic terms, what Equitable was doing was writing uncovered interest rate options. I mean, that is the essence of what they did for a very long period of time. How were they reserved for? How did they appear in the accounts? Well, you couldn't find them because the approach taken by sort of actuarial-driven approach was, well, if you've written an option and it's currently out of the money, it doesn't have a cost, does it? And it never has. It has no reserving for it whatsoever. Whereas, of course, a more banking-driven approach would say, well, looking at the future, at some point, this may well be in the money, and therefore some probability must be attached to that possibility, and some reserving must be applied. You may get that wrong, but you know, nonetheless, there would be some kind of option pricing model used and some kind of reserving. And that is one respect in which the approach to capital in banking has, in my view, been preferable. The actuarial approach tends to say, well, if something wasn't the case for the last 20 years, it won't be the case for the next 20 years, and therefore we don't need to provide for it. More generally, the new Basel approach to capital, which says, well, you have a basic capital requirement, a basic minimum, and then you have an add-on or conceivably a subtraction in relation to what's called supervisory review, which is the second pillar where you look at the quality of management and risk management in the firm. And then thirdly, you have a disclosure regime under the third pillar. Is in our view, again, a better model to apply to the insurance industry than the one that's typically been the case in the past. Now, we hope that we will apply this kind of technology in a way which is sensitive to the needs of the insurance industry. And so if we're not doing that, and if we are appearing just to paint banking rules onto the insurance industry in an insensitive way, then that's a problem. We shouldn't be doing that. But nonetheless, I think that one of the advantages of a single regulator is that we have been able to achieve some intellectual cross-fertilization, if you like, between the approaches taken to risk and capital in one sector and in another. And frankly, the learning, I think, has been across from banking to insurance more than it has been the other way around.
Thank you. There was a question over there, this gentleman on the edge.
Terry Milgram, I had a publication called The Green Paper. This week's New Statesman, actually, in the editorial, deals with Murdoch and Channel 5. There's a sentence in it which means you're prompted by a question. And it means, we're told that to compete internationally, Britain needs strong, well-resourced media groups. This is nonsense. What nonsense this is. Is it nonsense that Britain needs strong financial or any other country sort of global institutions?
It's difficult. I mean, it sounds like a sort of tedious philosophical response, but the question, I suppose, is what you mean by Britain. In that, I think if you talk about the retail market and the needs of British investors, well, I think it's generally advantageous for domestic investors to have access and convenient access to a range of investment opportunities which are not exclusively domestic. Those could be offered by domestic firms, but typically they are not, and typically they are offered most attractively by firms who also have an international dimension. And so I think that there is an attraction from a sort of retail investor point of view in having access to international investment opportunities. From the point of view of companies raising money, then I think there is some advantage as well in being able, through institutions with which you can deal locally, to access an international investor base, because I believe that in general, as a matter of principle, that ought to reduce your cost of capital. If you can access a wider range of investors who may have different risk characteristics, some of whom may find it attractive to own a piece of a British company as part of an overall portfolio diversification strategy, you ought, the theory would tell you, to be able overall to reduce your cost of capital by accessing a broader base of investors. So both from an investor point of view and from a capital raiser point of view, I think you have some attractions from being able to access the international capital markets. Now you may say, you can do that without necessarily having those international capital markets located on your doorstep, and that's possibly theoretically true, but I suppose it's practically cheaper and easier if you do have at least arms of international capital markets on your doorstep. There is a further point, of course, that these mobile financial institutions are themselves wealth creators for wherever they are. And so I think all other things being equal, you would say that if you can get a piece of that internationally mobile financial activity, then you should do so unless you fear it otherwise is damaging your economy. I can't honestly see why we should believe that attracting internationally mobile financial business to the city is damaging to our economy. Sometimes maybe we overstate its significance to the UK economy or to ordinary people in the United Kingdom, but on the whole, it seems to be quite a sizable business and employment generator, and one which we should try to keep here if we can, as long as we don't do so at the expense of other objectives. And that's why we have our sort of balancing requirements of looking at international competitiveness, but also looking at market confidence and stability and protection of consumers as well. So all other things being equal, I think we should try to keep it.
A forest of hands, but not much time. I'll take the chap in the middle over here in the blue. This, I think, will probably be the last question.
Hi, my name is Robert Schiff. I'm an undergraduate here. To move away from the banking sector a little bit, Director Giddens conducts regular director's dialogues with public figures a few times a year. If you were to continue this, who would you invite?
Yeah, I can't invite myself, of course, and I'm certainly the most, I find myself the most interesting person I know, really. But, I think, who would I want? It's an extremely, extremely good question. I think there are, would be nice to feel that one could bring back to the LSE a number of the distinguished alumni who are out there and who I think would like, from my brief experience as a director designate, would actually like to re-establish some contact with the school, and that would be a good opportunity to do it. And the sort of people I'm thinking of, one person who's been in the news not particularly favorably just the other day is Phil Purcell, the head of Morgan Stanley in New York, who was at LSE. And I think someone like him would be an extremely interesting person to bring back. He's been through the mill recently, and his perspective on your sort of question as to how the market was allowed to go crazy and what we can learn from that would, I think, be an interesting one. And it would also be fun for him, I think, to come back to the school. I hope there would be enough interest to get the guy I met last week in Jamaica, whose name you wouldn't know, but who is trying to deal with the aftermath of a financial crisis in Jamaica, which actually, in terms of GDP, is four times as serious as the crisis in Indonesia. When the Jamaican government ended up with a debt of 65% of GDP in relation to failed financial institutions, and he's been, as an LSE alumnus, given the opportunity of trying to mop that up. And I think his experience over the last few years as how to deal with that sort of crisis in a developing economy is actually really fascinating. He's a very interesting guy, and I hope that there would be enough interest here to hear from someone like him. So those would be the sort of people I think it would be very interesting to hear from, to be able to identify those alumni from around the world who've really been through some marking experience and are prepared to come back and share their experience here.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating talk. Thank you.